Good morning, and welcome back to Nippon 2.0. This is your host, Mike Hirier. And for those of you in the United States, happy 4th of July. I'm recording this on July 4th, 2015. And 4th of July is always just a great holiday. It's a great time to spend with your family and friends, and barbecues, hamburgers, hot dogs, and the like, as well as fireworks. But I think it's also a great opportunity for us to remind ourselves of how, you know, lucky we are here in the U.S. With you know, personal freedoms, and really all the opportunities that a society can provide for an individual to really have a, you know, great lifestyle and be able to provide. And to excel in life. I know, you know, there are times when it feels like a lot of things are working against you, but having traveled a good part of the world, I can tell you with confidence that the U.S. does a pretty darn good job in, you know, providing for and creating an environment where all of us can really just pursue happiness. I believe that's somewhere in the Declaration or of Independence, right? So today, I'm actually going to take the show in a little bit of a different way because I've been talking a lot about some of the culture, the cuisine of Japan in my first three episodes. And I'm going to go down a little bit of a historical route today. I'm not a history buff by any means, and I'll probably get a number of, you know, dates wrong. Actually, I'm going to try and stay away from dates because it's not really my strong suit. But I'm going to cover the history of U.S. and Japan relations, which is obviously pretty complicated. You know, it's obviously had its low point during World War II, but there's a lot of really positive interactions between the two countries. Actually, we've got a big game tomorrow. It's the Women's World Cup finals, where the Japan side and the ladies from the U.S. Will be competing for the FIFA World Cup. So very excited about that game. I'll tell you right off the bat. I'm happy with whoever wins. I'm probably rooting just a tad more for the Japanese side, and because I'm just a fan of Japanese sports when they compete internationally, like in the Olympics and such. But anyway, I'm really excited about that game. Getting back on topic, the U.S. and Japan have had a very complicated history, and it dates way back into the 1800s. When the U.S., like much of Europe, started to explore and send ships to the far parts of, you know, civilization to do trade and really learn more about the world that we live in, right? Now, this is back into the days of, you know, naval navigation, right? And obviously the British, the Dutch, the Spanish, were all taking to the high seas. Many were actually trading with India and China before they were trading with Japan. So Japan, having had a little bit of exposure to the outside world, took it upon themselves to create a policy where they would cut off all communication with, you know, with foreigners. And this policy lasted for, you know, many, many eras within Japan's history, you know, under the rule of the shoguns. And it really took, you know, cannons to open up Japan. So if I understand it correctly, right, the Dutch were allowed to trade with Japan. They were given an exception, and the Dutch brought Christianity to Japan, and this is, you know, during even the feudal era of ongoing war between the samurai. And, during this time, Christianity was introduced. But the Americans were basically locked out, as was any of the other European powers. And so what you saw in The Last Samurai, that was a pretty gross inaccuracy, right? The Americans were not really brought in to console or provide military equipment to the samurai, like you saw with, you know, Tom Cruise and Ken Watanabe. The Dutch were the primary, conduit to the outside world. They were given the one exception. They were only allowed to trade in places like Nagasaki and Yokohama. You know, these are the port cities that were allowed access to the Dutch. So getting back on track, the Americans sent the black ships, or what are known in Japanese as, I believe they're just a literal translation, which is the Kurofune. And the black ships were, I think, three, major war vessels managed or piloted by Commodore Perry. And Commodore Perry arrived in Tokyo Bay, and he basically delivered a message from the president or the Congress or whoever it was, and said, we would like to open up trade with Japan. And they were, the U.S. was already, like I said earlier, doing trade with India and with China, and so Japan was a nice stopping over place for their ships, right? They can pick up more, goods to trade. Their sailors can rest, because if you look at a map and if you're sailing from the West Coast, Japan is pretty much the first piece of land you'll hit before you get to the Asia continent. So it was really important that Japan open up, and so rather than send a purely, diplomatic convoy of very friendly looking ships, the U.S. sent these big black ships with all these cannons, right? And it was really a demonstration of America's military might. And what Commodore Perry said was, in a year or 2 years or whatever it was, he said, I'm going to come back and I hope to get, a positive decision, positive response. So he left, and Japan basically was kind of in that shock and awe. The Japanese, although were very attuned to war, they didn't really have a navy at the time, right? And so they were not prepared for those black ships, and they would not know what to do should those black ships return and want to wage war, right? Japan just didn't have the technology to defend itself for something like that. And they tried to install some simple defenses in Tokyo Bay, if I understand it correctly. And there are even some artifacts of that today in Tokyo Bay that show some of the simple defense measures that Japan took, should Commodore Perry return, and they would have to wage war. In a year or 2 years' time, Commodore Perry returns, the black ships are back, and the Japanese government said, okay, let's open up. And that was really when Japan took a hard look at itself and said, wow, we're pretty far behind our Western counterparts. And this is really this was what kicks off the Meiji Restoration. Meiji is one of the emperors. He's the father of Emperor Hirohito, who was the standing emperor during World War II. And so Meiji, he westernized Japan, right? And this led to Japan becoming a naval power, an imperialist power, and it kind of sets the initial footsteps for the environment that became World War II. So during Meiji and into the beginning of, Showa, which is the era of Emperor Hirohito, the U.S. and Japan, start to do quite a bit of trading. Japan finds America to be quite advanced. And so things like cars, the Ford Model T and clothing and all these other American goods start to show up in Japan, right around the early 1900s, all the way leading up to World War II. And that's, before I get into World War II, let me also say there was also a huge migration, migratory activity occurring during this time. So, early 1900s, a lot of companies, trading companies, started to advertise the need for Japanese agricultural experts and laborers to go work in the other parts of the world, right? So Hawaii being one for sugar plantations, the West Coast for other agriculture. We've got plenty of different kinds of fruits and vegetables that we manufacture here in California and Oregon and Washington, right? Everything from apples to strawberries. And other crops, as well as, in Brazil with coffee and they make all sorts of stuff in Brazil and Peru. And so a lot of Japanese, took these offers, especially, some of the Japanese that, saw this as an opportunity, right? I would say most of these Japanese did not see, them going to these places and settling down for many generations. They probably looked at it as a job, right? They were going to go and they're going to work in Hawaii or in the West Coast of the U.S. and Brazil, Peru, and then come back. But it actually, it didn't turn out that way. Especially in Hawaii, where they went to, work in the sugar plantations and pineapple fields, a lot of Japanese were actually later allowed to bring over women, and so they settled down, they had families, and the same was true in the West Coast, and parts of South America. This is what was the whole picture bride phenomenon. There was actually a movie produced in, I think, the 80s, about this, right? And so, a lot of these Japanese laborers started to settle down and have children, and those children were, then educated and carried, citizen rights in a lot of these countries, especially in the United States. And so we have here in the U.S. a lot of Japanese Americans today can trace their lineage to these original immigrants 4 or 5 generations ago, my family included. And so we have here a very, old, lineage, old footprint of Japanese ancestry in, these parts of the world because of these early immigrants. Now, let me talk about World War II, and I'm just going to hit it very, very quickly because, we've only got, I was trying to do this whole show in 30 minutes, and so I'm trying to cover, 200 years of history in 30 minutes. It's not easy. So Japan, being the aggressor, was aggressively expanding into China and Manchuria. This kicks off a number of economic sanctions against Japan by the Western powers, and December 7th is when Japan launched their secret attack against Pearl Harbor, and that basically kicks off World War II. This attack on the United States erupts into a lot of civil anger, and a lot of Americans of military age, then signed up for service. Many of these boys ended up in the European theater, but many also ended up in the Pacific theater as well. And so there was a lot of, you know, very heavy conflict in the Pacific, primarily, you know, amongst, you know, Navy sailors, with, you know, naval battles like Midway, for example, but also, you know, Marines, as they were hopping islands in the South Pacific, moving into the Japan main islands. And this is where, you know, Iwo Jima and the Battle of Okinawa, this is, you know, when a lot of American service members and Japanese died. It's probably the lowest point, right, of U.S. and Japan relations, obviously. This is when, you know, the two governments are at war and you've got thousands of casualties on both sides. You know, this apexes with the dropping of two atomic bombs by the U.S. on Japan's homeland to bring a quick and abrupt ending to World War II. The first one being at Hiroshima, the second one being at Nagasaki. And actually, I've been to both cities and, you know, visited the atomic memorials and museums. If you're ever in Japan and in those parts of the country, I'd highly recommend that you go and see, you know, some of the artifacts and pictures and memorials and to, you know, the people who perished. But I think it also opens your eyes to just the magnitude and power of weapons of mass destruction. It's quite breathtaking. And so World War II ends. Hirohito announces for the first time on public radio that he is not a god, that he is a, you know, just a human being like the rest of us. And this, you know, starts down the path of reforming Japan under this time General MacArthur. So, you know, if the Japanese, if you ask any Japanese, they'll probably tell you that they know at least three Americans, right? They know Commodore Perry, they know General MacArthur, and they know Barack Obama. But General MacArthur played a very heavy role in the shape of future or, you know, current day Japan. General MacArthur could have done anything. He could have executed Hirohito, like they did with you know, General Tojo and all these other military collaborators. He could have done a number of different things, right? But for the most part, I think General MacArthur recognized that he had, you know, this country, and he felt that he needed Japan to counter the growing threat of communism that was spreading in places like in China and in Korea. And so the Japanese people, I think, credit General MacArthur with taking the correct measures in positioning Japan for future success. And really, you know, Japan was able very quickly, in a matter of, you know, two decades, right, from the ending of World War II in 1945 to the 60s, those 20 years, you saw a huge expansion in the Japanese economy. And a lot of those tricks of the trade, they got from the United States. So, you know, you can't look at Toyota and Honda. You can't look at Sony and Panasonic without looking at those American counterparts and competitors, because a lot of the business practices and technologies they were able to mimic and copy and improve upon by their American competitors. And so within this 20 years, right, we have the bubble years. Actually, you can probably trace the bubble years all the way into, you know, probably the early or mid 80s, before, you know, the recession really set in. And, you know, within those, you know, 40 years, Japan went from the shambles of World War II, where, I mean, you know, literally you had massive inflation, you know, the yen was worthless, to becoming the second largest economy in the world, just recently surpassed by China. Now Japan is, you know, the third largest economy by, you know, by GDP measures. And so during this time of the bubble years, Japan, you know, exchanged and traded, and actually I think, I don't know what the current numbers are, but, you know, they were the largest trading partner with the United States. A lot of Japanese goods ended up in the U.S. shores. There was quite a bit of protective policies in place in Japan for U.S. goods. They, you know, and this was, if you remember, you know, kids of the 80s will remember all of the Buy American slogans, right? There were a lot of movies about Japanese car manufacturers competing here in the United States. One very funny movie, Gung Ho, was one that, you know, I remember from my childhood. But, you know, during this time, I would say Japanese and the U.S. were starting to rebuild a lot of their damaged relationship from being at war with each other, you know, during the 40s. So let's, you know, spend the last 10 minutes or so talking about today, right? So you can obviously see the history between Japan and the U.S. has been very complicated. But I would say for the most part today, you know, the younger generations of Japanese hold America in very high regard. Many do not even really think about, you know, the images of Hiroshima and Nagasaki or Pearl Harbor, right, when America is brought up to mind. Now, I can't say that's true of Americans if you ask them what the image of Japan is, but I can definitely say with a fairly high level of confidence, generally speaking, that Japanese today, the young kids, have a very, very high regard for the United States. And, you know, this has a lot to do with American media, right? The movies that come out of Hollywood, the music. You know, hip hop has had probably a large part of it, and rock and roll. But Japanese are today fascinated, you know, with everything American, more so than anything from, you know, France or Germany or the UK. I would say Americans hold, you know, anything American really does sell quite well in Japan. Japanese, while generally speaking, are not great at English, they consider, you know, American English as kind of the standard, which is kind of odd, right? Because I think for traditionalist, British English is probably closer to proper English. But nonetheless, Japanese are attuned to the American accent. And so, you know, and a lot of American, you know, young men and women are serving in Japan as teachers. And so a lot of the English that they do hear is probably the American flavor of English. You know, even today, there are thousands, tens of thousands of American soldiers servicing actively in Japan. So I know there's a very large Air Force base in Yokosuka outside of Tokyo. There's Futenma. There's, which I believe is in Okinawa. Okinawa actually has the largest percentages of American servicemen in Japan today, and Japan serves as a very important strategic play against, you know, the growing and aggressive stance that China is taking with regards to their growing military and naval presence, and a lot of the weird things that they're doing in the South Pacific, the South China Sea, with trying to control trading lanes and things like that. So the U.S. is paying very close attention to that and leveraging a lot of the bases in Japan strategically, as they should. Japan also relies very heavily on the United States for its military defense. That was actually one of the articles signed as a result of World War II, that Japan renounces the right to wage war. And so they don't have an offensive military. They do have a defensive military. It's quite well, manned and budgeted. But they rely, almost entirely on America to protect its borders. And it's kind of like a NATO-type alliance. And so I'll also say, the Japanese send quite a number of students to the United States. Many come here on student visas. If you're an American and you're curious what your reception would be in Japan, I would say extremely positive. Because, despite the fact that our two countries were at war and it was a very bloody conflict, those kinds of negative tensions run deep, especially in that generation. The younger generation, doesn't have really an inkling of hatred towards America. And so, I think as an American, if you're traveling in Japan, you're going to get a very positive reception. I always have. And so I think, again, that, Japan and the United States, although a very complicated relationship with a very complicated past, today is very, very healthy. And, Prime Minister Abe was in D.C., addressed Congress, first time in a very, very long time that a Japanese head of state did that. And Obama is, frequently in Japan. JFK's daughter, Carolyn Kennedy, is actually the ambassador to Japan today, as appointed by Barack Obama. And so I think the United States still holds Japan very much in high regard, one of their biggest friends in the Pacific, and Japan definitely. I mean, they value the American relationship, and I think that trickles down to the people of Japan. And I hope, with the people of the United States, hopefully this podcast will help and expose and explain a lot of how Japan and its people work. So thank you again for joining me on this podcast project. And I hope to see you in future episodes. And tomorrow, let's have a great game. I hope... if you're rooting for the U.S. side or the Japan side, irregardless, let's just have a great game in the name of, good sportsmanship. So, signing off. Thanks for listening.